Sidearm, dear listeners, and welcome to our new series on Dharma, presented by Professor G. Venkatraman. Today, we present Professor's third talk in the series. Over now to Professor Venkatraman.
Loving Sairam and greetings from Prashanti Nilayam. This is my third talk in the current Dharma series. In my last talk, I began taking a close look at the first formal chapter of the book by Gurcharan Das. And the title of that chapter was Duryodhana's Envy. That is to say, in the book, it is formally chapter 1. Prior to that, there was prelude. Today, I am continuing my analysis of the chapter titled Duryodhana's Envy because there is so much in that chapter to comment upon. In case I am not able to complete that task in this talk, I would leave what remains to the next one. As we saw earlier, the root of the problems faced by the Pandavas lay in Duryodhana's uncontrollable envy. For Duryodhana, the Pandavas had to be somehow put down so that he had the upper hand. Shakuni, the schemer par excellence, suggests to Duryodhana that this could be easily achieved by exploiting Yudhishthira's weakness for the dice game. It is true that back then, a symbolic dice game was a part of the Vedic ritual associated with the Rajasuya Yajna. Furthermore, this dice game was expected to be played where the yajna was actually being performed. That being the case, we are left wondering why then the game was not played in the palace of the Pandavas, which was in their kingdom Indraprastha, but was actually played in Hastinapura, where the palace of the Kauravas was located. One theory suggests that just before the Rajasuya yajna was about to be performed, sage Vyasa appeared there and told Yudhishthira that about 13 or 14 years later, the entire Kshatriya race would be wiped out and that he, Yudhishthira, would be the cause of it. Apparently, upon hearing this dire prediction of Vyasa, Yudhishthira immediately decided he would henceforth always try to oblige the Kauravas and thereby avoid any friction with those people. This way, Yudhishthira hoped, war could be avoided and the Kshatriya race preserved as well. This, Gurcharan Das suggests, might have been one of the reasons why Yudhishthira agreed to an away dice game in the palace of the Kauravas, rather than play the game on home ground, as Vedic rituals specify. Das offers other speculations, but in the end, things happened in their own mysterious way, culminating in war and destruction, exactly as sage Vyasa had foretold. So Das thus asked the question, is this the epic Mahabharata's way of telling us that ours is an enigmatic, deficient and incompetent world where the ordinary human being does not know why he is born or when he will die, but only that he will die for sure? Das continues, what makes for uncertainty in our lives is often our own frailties. The moral flaws of human beings make our world full of vaishamya, unevenness, and bring about the nasty surprises that make us vulnerable. End of quote. Declaring that Duryodhana was one of the main causes for creating unevenness in the life of the Pandavas, Das then decides to explore Duryodhana's envious nature and proceeds even further to analyze the nature of envy itself in some detail. According to Das, Duryodhana decides he cannot be happy unless he can wreck Pandava's happiness. Okay, so what was it that made Duryodhana so unhappy? A partition of the original kingdom of the Kurus had been agreed to, and the kingdom was divided into two parts, one for the Kauravas and the other for the Pandavas. Furthermore, by cunning design, the barren half of the land was given to the Pandavas, which they accepted without even a murmur of protest. Both the Kauravas and Pandavas developed their respective kingdoms, but because of hard work, the progress made by the Pandavas stood out. That success infuriated Duryodhana because his attempt to put down the Pandavas by doling out barren land had totally failed. Das describes Duryodhana's mood by quoting the 19th century German philosopher Schopenhauer, who says, quote, "Because they feel unhappy, they cannot bear the sight of someone they think is happy. In the boundless egotism of our nature, there is joined, more or less in every human breast, a fund of hatred, anger, envy, rancor, and malice, accumulated like venom in a serpent's tooth." End of quote. This reminds me of a TV ad that ran many years ago, promoting a particular brand of television set. Showing a picture of the TV set and a caricature of a devil sporting a sinister smile, the ad's punchline was, "Neighbor's envy, owner's pride." Das gives much thought to examining why people become envious. In the process, he goes back to the scene where Duryodhana and his father have a conversation about sending an invitation to the Pandavas to come to their palace for playing a dice game. You may recall I referred to this in an earlier talk. I also drew attention then to the fact that initially Dhritarashtra was not happy about the idea of inviting the Pandavas for a dice game. In fact, he even tried to dissuade his son from engaging in such misadventures. Dhritarashtra says, and here I quote from Das's book, quote, "Envy of another is ignoble behavior. Be content with what you have. Perform your own duty. Therein lies your happiness." End of quote. Notice that the blind king makes a reference to duty. Duryodhana, who has a quite different view of duty, then replies. Once again I quote from Das. Quote, "A Kshatriya's duty is to prevail, great king. Whether by virtuous means or not, O bull among the Bharatas, he should go out like a charioteer and whip every corner of the earth into submission." End of quote. Now this exchange is interesting because duty is almost always regarded as something sacred, noble, and also involving some amount of sacrifice. Das also briefly mentions how Yudhishthira and Vidura view duty quite differently. He says, quote, "Other characters in the Mahabharata will contest Duryodhana's egoistic philosophy. Yudhishthira in particular will offer a competing view of the world based on dharma, which he explains is a universal duty of righteousness applicable to all and founded on non-violence, truth and a concern for others. So too will Vidura, whose moral thinking is based on the consequences of actions rather than duty." End of quote. We see here three different approaches to anchoring action to a principle, namely duty. Obviously, it should be a moral principle. That, however, is not explicitly mentioned, but is implied, I suppose. For Yudhishthira, action must be based on duty, dharma, etc., which suggests that Yudhishthira understands what dharma is all about. Vidura is on a parallel track, and for him, good actions are those that lead to a good end. In other words, Vidura believes that choices regarding actions must be made on the basis of the consequences that would follow. As for Duryodhana, he too tries to tie action to his perception of duty, which of course is very different. For Duryodhana, action need not be moral in the usually accepted sense. "However," said Duryodhana, "whatever I do is moral because I say so." Commenting on this, Das says, quote, "Duryodhana's view is by no means unusual. On the contrary, conquerors and rulers throughout history have espoused it. It is called realism or real politics by students of international politics." End of quote. The core idea behind real politics is that while idealism is fine and much to be desired, what works in the real world of politics are down-to-earth and practical ideas. To suit this requirement, the fundamental principle underlying good action is suitably diluted in the name of pragmatism, which then gives one the elbow room to lay down individualized rules that allows sufficient space for equivocation and also to make the claim, heads I win, tails you lose. In other words, the feeling is, what is good for me is good for all. Presently, traditional moral values have been degraded to such an extent that it is often said that he who has gold and the gun makes the rules. Interestingly, this idea seems to go back all the way to Duryodhana. Currently, this business of constantly tweaking basic moral principles in the name of pragmatism is very much in the vogue, and we shall return to it later when market-related matters come up for discussion. Meanwhile, let us examine the various ways in which envy stroke jealousy can arise. We start with two individuals, A and B, who are equal in terms of social status, salary, the job held, and so on. Under the circumstances, one would imagine that there is little scope for any envy or jealousy between these two persons, A and B. Reality, it turns out, is far more complex. Although A as well as B might appear to be parametrically equal, nevertheless, it might still happen that A feels that he has been unjustly given the same status as B, even though he is far more talented. A's perception might be wrong, but people do have perceptions of being unfairly treated. The question can be asked, well, if A is all that smart, why then does he not get a different job where his merit is recognized? Das feels that in a highly controlled economy as existed in the former Soviet Union, people's salaries followed the Marxist cry, from each according to ability to each according to his need. In such a situation, merit has a good chance of being ignored. Having pointed out that, Das also gives other examples to make clear that such envy is possible even in capitalist economies, despite the fact that meritocracy prevails in capitalist economies, especially in the business world. Turning from individuals to society, society also can become split by jealousy, sense of injustice, exploitation, etc. At one end, we have a scenario in which an ethnic minority that works hard and with due diligence eventually manages to occupy a very high percentage of top posts, acquire status, and enjoy a good standard of living, besides also having access to power. The majority who are the natives of the country soon begin to feel that their space and privileges have been stolen right under their nose by the ethnic minority. Such a situation invariably leads to much anger and even strong hatred. The poisonous flames of hatred that Hitler fanned against the Jews is not only a classic example, but also a dire warning. In the post-war years, there have been many examples of ethnic tension, often as the result of importation of cheap labor. It all starts when people in a country begin enjoying a good standard of living and are no longer prepared to do low-wage jobs that not only involve drudgery, but are also regarded as beneath one's dignity to engage in. For a while, everything is fine, until one fine day, the locals realize that the immigrant population has become pretty large, following which there is ethnic tension. The once welcome laborers are now seen as a great threat and are no longer wanted. What operates here is not envy or jealousy, but the fear that the once subservient workers would now start encroaching into the religious, cultural, and possibly even political space of the majority. That is when local politicians begin to scream and pour vitriol on immigrants. Any number of examples can be given, and the point to notice that besides envy and jealousy, fear, whether justified or not, can also create a dangerous tension. Lastly, we have situations where extreme economic inequity provokes uncontrollable rage in the exploited segment of the population, who also happen to be in the majority. On such occasions, there have been bloody revolutions, and this has happened in Imperial France and Tsarist Russia, where an aristocratic minority monopolized the wealth, leaving the poor in dire and unbearable condition. For long, the poor suffered silently, but when their rage exploded, there was a bloodbath that almost completely wiped out the exploiters. Here we must note that envy, jealousy and fear all get first seeded in the mind. The mind, said someone whose name I cannot remember, is so clever that it can deceive itself. In my view, this is a profound fact that we hardly ever appreciate. The mind is very good at spin and at times starts believing the very myths it creates. Duryodhana, for example, believed that it was the duty of the Kshatriya to be at the top, even if it meant adopting methods that did not meet the requirements of morality. This practice of morphing morality to suit the situation is described as being realistic or pragmatic, and where politics or matters of the state are concerned, being pragmatic is referred to by scholars as real politics. Even to this day, some of the high and mighty declare themselves to be exceptional and claim special rights in the name of exceptionalism. In their view, if wars become necessary to protect their self-interest, then they have to be waged. That's all there is to it. No doubt some innocent people would die. That is sad and unfortunate. But then, wars these days always result in collateral damage, do they not? Nevertheless, such wars also lead to larger good, and that is what ultimately matters. So goes the self-justification. Das points out that in truth this is nothing but jungle law or the big fish eating small fish syndrome, Matsya Nyaya as it is referred to in Sanskrit. It is true that in nature the big fish does eat the small fish, but then few are aware that this is part of nature's operating system, OS, and that nature has allowed this to happen with a purpose. You may be interested to know that many mathematicians of the 19th century independently tackled this pre-predator phenomenon and figured it all out. Italian mathematician Volterra was one of the first to do so. From a physical point of view, the small fish basically provide food for the big fish. When the small fish are available in plenty, the population of the big fish begins to grow and increase. However, when too many predators compete for food, the small fish get eaten up so fast that its population begins to decline rapidly. At this stage, there are too many big fishes chasing too few small fishes. The result is that the big fish begin to starve and die in large numbers. With the decline in the numbers of the predators, the small fish now begin to enjoy safety and start multiplying fast. Food for the big fish becomes abundant once more, following which their population begins to rise. In short, the population of the two species wax and wane in alternation. The point is that nature sees to it that the fates of the prey as well as the predator are linked in such a manner that both species survive, maintaining an overall balance. In other words, in nature's operating system, the two species, the prey and the predator, need each other, and any one of the two species cannot survive by itself. Thus, nature makes sure that in the overall scheme of things, both species have their place. This is what sustainability is all about, and it is necessarily built on recognizing mutual dependence. Nature's operating system in maintaining biological balance is actually a bit more complicated, because both the small as well as the big fish live in water. It might be a river, a lake, or even the ocean. Each water body has its own particular ecosystem, and nature always works to preserve an overall macro balance across the entire system, ecosystem I mean. This topic would come up again later when we deal with the relationship between the individual and society as a whole. For now, the take-home lesson is that Matsya Nyaya is not what it might appear to be. While domination of the weak by the strong and the mighty is possible on a relatively short time scale, predatory tactics would always fail in the long run because we are all a part of nature, and Mother Nature has built interdependence into a larger scheme of things. Sadly, the market of today seems to be too preoccupied with itself to recognize the subtleties of nature. Maybe the feeling is that market being a creation of humans has nothing to do with nature. The point is that when people drift away from dharma, problems become inescapable. And what diverts people's attention from righteousness are the 6 well-known viruses that infect the mind, and to which Swami referred ever so often. These 6 viruses have always been around. They had their play at the time of the Mahabharata, and they continue to do so even presently, with greater ease in fact, which is why author Das frequently takes a close look at the current scene. At this point, let me make it absolutely clear that I am not anti-market. In fact, it would be utterly stupid to adopt such an attitude. What is market? It is just another name for trade and commerce, which go back to very early times when people started using the barter system for trading. Later, coins came into existence, which boosted trade considerably for obvious reasons. People have always engaged in trade and commerce for their own personal benefit and putting some food on the table. Nevertheless, out of this global network of self-interest also came larger good, especially when the producers and traders spontaneously obtained from profiteering or were restricted from doing so by regulations. Until not so long ago, business in America was substantially regulated. But around the 1970s, the market there underwent a huge change, which was the result of adopting a radically different economic philosophy long advocated by one school of economists, especially in Chicago. Later, the ideas proposed by the Chicago School of Business were formally implemented by Margaret Thatcher of the United Kingdom and Ronald Reagan, the President of America. According to this new market theory, a regulated market was an enemy to economic growth, and what was needed for growth was to get rid of the government regulations. As Mrs. Thatcher famously said, "The business of the government is to get out of business." That was what the UK and America did during the 1970-1980 period, and promptly their economies began to boom. Young entrepreneurs took full advantage of this newly available economic freedom and introduced a variety of innovations, following which growth took off like a rocket. Things looked very rosy for a while, but then a market without regulations also opens up possible opportunities for hanky-panky, which many seized eagerly with both hands. That, in turn, quickly led to downright cheating, corruption and whatnot. In due course, the inevitable happened. A massive market bust took place, which ruined the lives of literally millions. In short, following economic liberalization, the market embraced Matsya Nyaya, law of the jungle, social Darwinism, whatever you want to call it. In practical terms, in the free market system, the winner took all. Many rationalize this by saying, when you play a game, one side wins and the other side loses. Only in the market, as in elections, the winner takes all. The one who loses gets nothing. There's really nothing wrong or unjust about it. Now that is the way this was rationalized. Speaking recently in a TV show, CEO of Goldman Sachs, the number one investment banker in America and probably the world, said in reply to a question about market fairness, "Listen, here in America, we have a principle, which is that the winner takes all. That is what America is all about, competition." When the CEO was then asked, "What happens to the losers?" the gentleman said, "Yes, we do have losers, and the losers do have a problem, but hopefully social welfare organizations would take care of them." Those are not the exact words the CEO spoke, but I am recalling from memory, and I believe I have captured the essence of his argument. Gone is the traditional sense of compassion that was widely prevalent in America of the 1960s, that I have personally witnessed and experienced. It came as a rude shock to me that presently, in that same America, the wealthy have become absolutely indifferent to the misery of their own people who belong to the middle and lower classes. I brought in economic reforms because since 1990, India has begun increasingly adopting similar market reforms. It is true that way back in 1990, there was a good reason to go in for such reforms. Back then, India's growth had stalled and our economy had begun to stagnate. In fact, it was ready to grind to a complete halt. That was when the country decided to slacken tight government control, which immediately paid dividends. The GDP began to shoot up, the shops were full of goodies we earlier just dreamt about, and people in general began to feel things were improving. However, slowly problems also started rising, with education becoming unaffordable for most, unemployment increasing, and so on. What to do next became the question, with the right clamoring for more reforms to stimulate growth, and the left screaming, enough is enough. It has been observed that wherever and whenever these so-called reforms are implemented, almost invariably the income gap widens. The rich become richer, much richer in fact, while the lower middle class and the poor slide down to the bottom of the economic pyramid. Where India is concerned, it is certainly true that the dire and abject poverty one saw before independence, and by the way, I have seen it, existed for a couple of decades after independence also, but it is no longer to be found. Having said that, it's also a fact that jobs in rural areas have now become very scarce, while prices have soared compared to earlier times. Where the rural poor are concerned, this is a double whammy. Pundits argue, what are you complaining about? Look at all the progress the country has made. See how modern our airports are. Just check how many people are flying these days, how many people own cars and so on. You will find there is a lot of progress. Yes, the poor face some hardships, but this happens everywhere. The point is that things are changing for the better, and the poor just have to wait for their chance. They must have patience and the belief that one day they too would be well off. I would say that's a nice try in offering consolation, but here there are some dark facts. Statistics show that as of today, one-third of the world's poor live in India. One-third of all the poor people in the world live in just one country. Did you know that? And are you aware that that statistic translates as the following? There are more poor people in India, which is just one country, than there are in the whole of Africa, which is an entire continent. Can you imagine that? Added to all that, we have right today close to 400 million youth, which is more than the entire population of America, which is about 300 million plus. Tell me, when education becomes unaffordable, millions of young people who are poor would be forced to remain uneducated. How can they get jobs when they are uneducated? How can they live without any job? And what would they eat? How would they eat? How long can they go on bearing this desperate situation? That is the issue we have to face, especially because the list of problems is much longer than what I have conveyed to you. When I raise such issues, many counter me with the remark, listen, you are talking sociology, economics and politics. What have they got to do with spirituality? Nothing. Spirituality is all about the individual. So talk to us about Swami and not about all these things. Okay, I shall do precisely that. Not by telling stories about miracles and experiences, but by drawing attention to some of Swami's teachings. Here is a bit of Swami's teachings, paraphrased for convenience. This is what Swami has been telling us in essence. Listen, God is everywhere, which means that He is also in you. You seek God outside by visiting temples, bathing in sacred rivers and offering worship to idols. Fine, but do you realize that while you are so engaged, you are forgetting that God is also in you? You are also forgetting that God has given you a powerful mind and a body with amazing abilities. Why? Is it not to manifest the spark of divinity latent within you? In truth, God is waiting for you to open the door of your heart and make use of the precious treasures He has specially kept there for you. And what are those treasures? They are pure love, the spirit of sacrifice, compassion, forbearance, and so on. Instead of using that wealth for doing my work, you are instead paying more attention to the safe that holds these treasures, namely the body. I have endowed you with amazing capabilities, like an extraordinarily powerful mind, for example. Why did I do that? So that you could tap all the capabilities within you and serve me. Why do I want you to serve me? because selfless service is the easiest road leading back to me. And how do you serve me? By seeing me everywhere. That is to say, by serving whatever you see by invoking my name. If, for example, you see a person in distress, then help and comfort that person seeing me in that person. If you see a poor child roaming aimlessly, try to educate that child, especially because it pleases me when unconditional love is offered to anyone. If you look around, there is so much of God's work waiting to be done. But these days, most of you are so busy with all sorts of things that you do not have time even for your own families. Where then is the chance of you thinking of me, your Creator? O humans, I am everywhere. And among other things, I act as an invisible cosmic thread, linking the divinity in the individual or vyashti with the divinity in society or samashti with the divinity in nature or srishti, and finally linking you to God or paramishti. You are struggling in the turbulent ocean of duality or bhavasagar because you have paid hardly any attention to the divinity immanent in you and around you, everywhere and everything, to the edge of space and time, and indeed even beyond. Unless you learn to experience God's omnipresence, your devotion to me would be partial, fragmented and incomplete. You may be satisfied with such constricted devotion, but in the larger scheme of things, it really does not mean much. Your love for God must seek to be complete in the sense I have just explained. Now, most people are likely to dismiss this as high and abstract philosophy, which has little to do with daily life. Even so, the point made above is important. Now, many years ago, when I was the Vice Chancellor of Swami's University, one of the examiners asked a student who had prepared a dissertation titled Bhagavad Gita and Management the following question. The examiner told the student, "Your title is exotic, but I want to know if your dissertation has an answer to a problem I have. My company has been locked out for over 3 months. The company is losing, and the employees also are losing because they are not getting any salary. We are losing because we are not getting profits, and employees are losing because they are not getting salary. Okay, now what does your Bhagavad Gita say about my problem? Does it offer any solution?" Now, as was to be expected, the student was totally stumped. "As for me, I decided then and there that I would immediately begin a careful study of the Gita and also Swami's teachings. And that process is still continuing, I may add. Now, I am drawing attention to this particular incident because it underscores the point that sociological and ideological differences can be resolved if we decide to inject humanness and moral considerations into conflict resolution. And the lessons for these are best learnt from the teachings of Lord Sri Krishna, repeated, amplified and clarified in detail by our own Swami. In my mind, there is no question about it. I shall, in one of my later talks, give the answer to the question asked by the examiner. But for now, let us return to market and the forces that drive as well as control it. As we all know, the market as such is an abstract entity and is the name given to a class of activities engaged in by humans." "Well, that is indeed correct, but it's also true that it is humans who shape the market, inasmuch as they vary in their nature and tendencies. That, you will remember, is what the gunas are all about. Thus, markets do carry the imprint of human behavior, culture, belief system, fickleness, and so on. Adam Smith, who gave socioeconomics its foundation, said, quote, "It is not from the benevolence of the butcher or the brewer or the baker that we expect our dinner, but from their regard to their own interest. We address ourselves not to their humanity, but to their self-love, and never talk to them about our own necessities of life, but of their advantages." Adam Smith also opined that markets have a built-in mechanism for automatically channeling self-interest towards socially desirable ends. This is often referred to as the invisible hand in operation, and has generated the belief that market has the ability to shape itself and correct itself. That is why free market theorists often raise the cry, leave the market alone and it would correct itself. There is no need for government intervention via rules, regulations and external controls. That is what the free market advocates say. But I am not so sure. If markets are not regulated, then the Shakuni types would take a large number of people for a huge ride. By dangling many attractive deals, the market is made to boom. Often the boom is entirely due to inflated expectations of investors who gamble with their money, hoping for a windfall. But what if not only individuals but corporate bankers also begin gambling, and that too with money deposited with them by trusting clients? When there is a real bust, it drags down all who took risks and gamble, hoping to make a killing. Something like that is precisely what happened during the famous Wall Street crash of 2008. This calls to mind the dire warning that Vyasa gave to Yudhishthira before the Rajasuya Yajna. Poor Yudhishthira thought he would avoid war at all costs by engaging in risky gambling. He lost, and despite his trying to be very obliging, there was finally a brutal war in which many, including Shakuni, perished. Only in the Wall Street crash, instead of people dying in large numbers, thousands lost their investments, while millions lost their jobs. True, the market has since recovered and even crossed earlier peaks, but millions continue to be unemployed. Those who have made it good now invoke the law of winner takes all, even as they lobby for the law to give them more tax breaks, etc. Seen in the light of all this, it is clear that the basic issues of life and the turbulent people face are closely linked to the tussle between the forces of good and the forces of evil in society. As the French say, the more things change, the more they remain the same. Indeed, everyone knows that dishonesty does not work forever. Yet, people always seem to think that they could take high risks in business, make a fast buck and get out before the roof crashes. However, risk-taking is like addiction, and once such an addiction develops, people keep on taking bigger and bigger risks. In short, when greed gets a foothold, normal business quickly morphs into plain old gambling, and that is when people get onto the slippery slope. Here, I must heartily commend Gurcharan Das, who is rightly upset by market irregularities and makes a genuine effort to seek answers in the Mahabharata. In my view, leading a dharmic life requires a moral GPS. Like the usual GPS available to us via a smartphone app, moral GPS also has a source, a reference, and that reference is the Gita, which, however, Das chooses to ignore for his own reasons. The Gita and how it offers an absolute reference frame for moral decision-making would be the recurring theme in this series of talks, and I would have plenty to say about it as we go along. For now, let me get back to the question that I ended my last talk with. I hope you recall what it was all about. Anyway, for your convenience, I'm repeating it. I said then, in terms of gunas, Duryodhana was A++ rajasic, while Yudhishthira could be described as sattvic A++. Now, how come a person with such exceptional guna rating lost his balance and kept on gambling to the point of losing even his wife? A sattvic person always consults the Atma before acting. That being the case, how come a person with AAA+ rating slipped so badly? That was my question. I'm sure many of you must have figured out the answer. In any case, it's my obligation to provide the answer, and to do so, I have to bring in buddhi, which is an aspect of the mind. According to Vedanta, the mind is not only distinct from the physical organ we call brain, but is also a subtle entity connected with thought, consciousness, awareness, and so on. The mind, says Vedanta, is made up of four different components or entities, they being manas, the thinking aspect, buddhi, the intellect or spiritual discrimination aspect, ahamkara or the ego aspect, and chitta, the memory aspect. Of these four, let us focus on buddhi, which is the agency that actually performs this task of spiritual discrimination, whether an action that a person intends to perform is morally right or morally wrong. Operationally, it is convenient to think of buddhi as a hotline to the atma. Keeping all this in mind, let us now return to the issue of why Yudhishthira acted the way he did. The answer is simple. Yudhishthira simply did not consult his buddhi when Shakuni dared him to wager his wife. Leaving aside all considerations, during a marriage, the husband takes a solemn vow to take full care of his wife, a promise made with the fire as the witness. That being the case, the question arises, how on earth did Yudhishthira, verily the son of Dharma himself, forgot his promise? Well, that is where the human frailty comes into the picture. Maybe, having had an unending series of bad luck, Yudhishthira was in such a state of severe shock that he became mentally paralyzed. Perhaps it was that paralysis that snapped the buddhi-atma connection. Whatever it is, the fact is that Yudhishthira failed to consult his conscience before acting, which ultimately led to massive problems. It is not for nothing that Swami constantly reminded us, I am in you, I am in you, I am in you. Among other things, this means, O man, I am always available to you as conscience, the voice of God within. Why do you always rush to knee-jerk reaction without using your buddhi first? Yudhishthira was fully aware of buddhi, but was probably too dazed to use it when he needed to most. That, in short, is the answer to the question raised. I'm sorry I have heavily overshot my time and offer my apologies for the same. Allow me to end my talk here at this point and thank you for your patience. As always, I offer this talk to our beloved Swami and take leave of you for now. Please stay with this series, which includes not only talks, but also Q&A sessions. God bless you. Jai Sai Ram.
Sai Ram. That brings to an end talk number 3 in Professor Venkatraman's current series on Dharma. We thank you for tuning in and hope you liked the program. Please do write to us with your questions and comments. And if you don't mind, kindly draw the attention of people who have missed this program to listen to it by downloading the podcast, which is available on our website www.radiosai.org. Thank you and Sai Ram.